Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're doing everything we can to help save this country. And the only way to do that is through the Constitution. We have to continue, I'll just say, educating and re-educating. Obviously, going to Sunday school once does not, you know, get a person to understand the scriptures, what they need to do. And it's the same thing with, you know, the Constitution, what we need to do, you know, what it means, how to understand what they're supposed to be doing. So that's why we need to continue to learn. So that's why we're going to continue teaching, so that you can learn, pray, and act. We also want to emphasize that it is all about full compliance to the Constitution. I mean, to one degree or another, I get engaged with folks from different institutions, and I have to quip. You know, it's not about the Supreme Court. People keep on going to the, you know, well, this, we got to go to the Supreme Court and let them definitize, you know, what needs to be done. They have no jurisdiction over things that do not arise under this Constitution, i.e. welfare, i.e. health care. They've assumed the jurisdiction, but the states need to put their foot down and say, that door doesn't open unless you can prove to us, until you can prove to us that this is an item that actually arises directly out of the Constitution, then we're done. We're not putting up with you absconding and usurping authorities that are not granted. So anyway, the states actually have to do this. Folks, Trump doesn't have the power to do it. At least he doesn't have the constitutional power to do it. There may be a lot of people that's convinced he can use the military to do whatever he wants to, just like Lincoln did. And we tell you that that was tyranny. So we have to, you know, if you don't like the progressive tyranny, why? What makes the conservative tyranny any better? Oh, because it's ours. We, you know, when we do it, it's good. It's for the good things. Anyway, I digress. We've got a lot. Go ahead. Welcome back, Tanya.
Thank you. I actually had a conversation with the former representative of the House here in Wyoming about how when he stated that when somebody at the federal level in the representative or Senate votes for something, then, you know, it's legitimate and we have to follow it because they voted for it and we voted for them and right now they're representing us, whether it's constitution or not. That's what he said. I couldn't believe it was coming out of his mouth. And he said, until somebody challenges it in court.
Uh-huh.
And so anyway, we had a back and forth conversation about everything you just said, that no, that's incorrect.
No, I know that wasn't Liz Cheney. Who was your representative before Cheney?
I don't remember.
Now, is this a state representative or a congressman?
This was a state representative. Former state representative.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I couldn't believe they were saying it.
Well, why not? Because that's exactly what the Wyoming court and almost every state court in the union is saying. Look, all of our statutes, every law that we have is constitutional until it's deemed by us, the court, that it isn't. And we're not challenging anything.
He even said that we were responsible for all of the debt because they voted for it, and until somebody challenged it, okay, it was legitimate.
Right. All right. So where we are today, and welcome back, Sean. We got Sean with us, folks. Yay. So,
yay.
So,
and it was Cynthia Lummis who was preceded Cheney.
Cynthia Lummis was, no, I thought Cynthia Lummis is a senator now. I thought, isn't she a senator?
She is.
Hageman is the representative now. She right. replaced
Before
Cheney.
Before Cheney, it was Lummis.
Yeah, that sounds correct.
Okay. All right. Now, was that who you were talking to? No, you said you were talking to a state guy, state person.
No, no, no. It was a former state representative.
Yeah, okay. That's all right. Anywho, so in the Constitution, the Constitution for the United States of America, we just wrapped up the attempted amendment to help regulate child labor in America by Calvin Coolidge. That was a 1926 attempted amendment. The next amendment that actually shows up is in 1932, and it was ratified in 1933, and it changes some administrative stuff. But what I want to point out is the fact that they're going through now. actually, let's do the first section, and then I'll point something out. Okay, so who wants to read? Sean, go ahead and start off, because this is your first time this week, and Tammy's already done a little load carrying. So go ahead.
Article 19.
Actually, this is the 20th Amendment, and It says Article 20.
Okay. Section 1. The terms of the President and Vice President shall end at noon on the 20th day of January, and the terms of Senators and Representatives at noon on the 3rd day of January, of the years in which such terms would have ended if this article had not been ratified, and the terms of their successors shall then begin.
Okay, so here's the question. What was it before? In the Constitution, there was really no hard date as to when the president would actually take office. They did it in March sometime, and that was just because weather conditions back in those days, life was a lot more arduous in fighting, you know, weather conditions and those types of things. They didn't have cars. They didn't have, you know, paved roads and so forth and so on. So traveling in the wintertime, even in the 30s, was kind of tough. I mean, air travel was not that common, and so I would presume that, as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, just a decade before, Harding traveled around the United States on a train, and I think that was the common mode for the president because it was the most efficient, you know, driving, having to have the human brakes and all of that, because, you know, once you get a train started, everything's kind of just on its own, kind of. I mean, you manage it, but it's not the same as driving. So you can literally cross the continent in a much faster, more efficacious manner. So anyway, the point is, now here's the question. Why did they write this amendment? Why didn't they just change it? Why didn't they do like they did with the Reapportionment Act of 1929, which we've never read on here, we probably should someday, but why did they actually make a hard amendment to the Constitution that this is when this would occur and actually, you know, ingrain this into the Constitution?
No idea.
Well, so for things to be properly done, that's what you have to do. But when it comes to assuming powers and inflicting pain upon the states, they don't need to amend the Constitution, just like we were talking about. Isn't it interesting that on the administrative stuff, even on other administrative stuff like the Apportionment Act, Congress came out, right, they used an act. They didn't create an amendment. So this is almost a slap of an insult in America's face to say, yeah, we know we need to do these things, but we're only going to do amendments that we know you'll give us, because if we ask you for, you know, controlling your labor, then you're not going to give that to us. So we're going to have to just forcefully assume these things and inflict it upon you. That is the message and has been the prevailing message for a long time. And I mean, it's been going way, 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 way back. Back to the Ponzi schemes and so forth. So, which, when I say the Ponzi schemes, I'm talking about 1816 and so forth, when all that stuff started happening. Now, go ahead and read Section 2, Tammy. Go ahead.
Okay. The Congress shall assemble at least once in every year and such meeting shall begin at noon on the third day of January, unless they shall by law appoint a different day.
And see, they actually had the latitude of being able to do it differently. As a matter of fact, if you really look at Congress, Congress was out of session, I think, usually, if not 6 months to 8 months a year, if not longer. They were only in session for short periods of time. And so, and actually, if I remember correctly, if I'm looking at the journal, the very first year was a really arduous, heavy work year. So when you look at Congress being in session, they picked up, I believe, their session. I think they formally formed their session in early March, if not April, and they worked all the way through that year to getting the Bill of Rights out and a lot of these other things done. And then they started really tailoring back on how much time they needed to be there. So that's why you see gaps then in the records, like they jump months, literally months. All of a sudden, there's nothing happening in the House or the Senate. Then all of a sudden, boom, they're doing all this work. That's because they weren't in session. They had to go home and support themselves. Anyway.
Right.
So it's ironic that they're actually doing this. And I just look at this whole amendment as a real embarrassment and a slap in the face of one of the, it's an offense to the Constitution that they do these types of amendments, but they don't do the ones that really inflict pain upon the states. And the states are not doing anything about it, but let's go ahead and, Sean, let's pick up Section 3.
Section 3, if at the time fixed for the beginning of the term of the president, the president-elect shall have died, the vice president-elect shall become president. If a president shall not have been chosen before the time fixed for the beginning of his term, or if the president-elect shall have failed to qualify, then the vice president-elect shall act as president until a president shall have qualified, and the Congress may by law provide for the case wherein neither a president-elect nor a vice president-elect shall have qualified, declaring who shall then act as president, or the manner in which one who is to act shall be selected, and such person shall act accordingly until a president or vice president shall have qualified.
Okay, so either of you have an inkling as to why they injected this? Go ahead. All or both?
Somebody died before they were put in office?
Okay, so when was Hoover elected? 1928 is when Hoover was elected. FDR was elected in 1932. And I'll bet you anything, when they saw that FDR was going to become the president, they put this in here. Why would they do this? Because of his health. The nation didn't even know the status of FDR, but Congress did, and they wanted to make sure that they had a contingency because the Constitution really didn't cover the potential of a president coming in that was going to die. I mean, they were... We talk and we hear people use a badge of honor of how their party is so transparent. I'll tell you what, the Democratic Party was not transparent at all. Not transparent at all. So, Tammy, let's go ahead and pick up Section 4. Thank you.
Okay. The Congress may by law provide for the case of the death of any of the persons from whom the House of Representatives may choose a president, whenever the right of choice shall have devolved upon them, and for the case of the death of any of the persons from whom the Senate may choose a vice president, whenever the right of choice shall have devolved upon them.
Okay, so so now they're kind of basically breaking it down a little bit further of succession plans and so forth, right? And so, Sean, let's go ahead and read Section 5, take a quick break, and I'll have you read Section 6, if you don't mind. Go ahead.
Section 5. Sections 1 and 2 shall take effect on the 15th day of October following the ratification of this article. Section 6. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission.
Okay, so what is that? What is Section 6 really doing?
Spelling out the procedure.
Well,
or amendment.
So
I mean,
so this is the first. This is not the first one, but this is one of the first ones that actually had an expiration. Does that make sense? All the other amendments were just basically laid out there, and they would continually lay there dormant until the state may come along and finish ratifying it. Just like the very first amendment of the Bill of Rights is still laying out there that could easily be amended, or I should say ratified, and put into force. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
All right. So when we look at why they started doing this, I think that there was this paradigm that, oh, you know, this is going to expire, and it got people moving because, and in all honesty, when I look at, because in our constitutional, color-coded constitution here, as you know, kind of just go from here up, you can see when they have submitted proposed 1970, you know, the 18th Amendment, proposed 1917, ratified in 1919, 2 years. The 17th Amendment, proposed in 1912, ratified in 19. I mean, if you go through and you look, what is the longest period of time that it took for an amendment or a group of amendments to get ratified? And even the 14th Amendment was 2 years. And as I look through this, I don't see why were they using these expiration dates? Who thought that this was necessary? But I'm glad that they did, because the Equal Rights Amendment was a really bad amendment, and putting an expiration in it actually ensured that it would die. So, anyway, okay, so let's go to the 21st Amendment. And Tammy, you're up with Section 1.
Okay, the 18th Article of Amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed.
Okay, so by repealing it, it basically means that everything in it is repealed, but not so fast. Sean, read Section 2.
The transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited.
Okay, so what are they saying? The transportation,
like, backing up the states.
But they're saying the transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery in use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is prohibited. So they repealed the Prohibition Amendment. But what are they saying here? What is prohibited? It's saying the transportation or importation into any state. So in other words, the shipping, the transporting, the possession. Go ahead.
Bootlegging.
Okay, but they're not saying that. I mean, shouldn't they say a non-registered production or things that aren't regulated? Or maybe they should actually grant right here that the United States has regulating authority over all intoxicating liquor. But that's not what they're saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay, so...
But that's their... It seems to me that's their sneaky way of birthing another department.
Which, right, they already did. They created the ATF.
Right, that's why they wanted to keep it. They wanted to keep it, so that's why they did that, I would think.
Okay. Yeah, so interestingly enough, because they already had, going all the way back to the Whiskey Rebellion, they've already been playing with, because the whole point of the government's involvement with anything would be the excise taxes that they place on it. Why would they actually add this type of prohibition on the transportation, importation, or possession of the United States? So territory or possession of the United States for delivery in or delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws there. I'm just having a problem understanding what the heck that. So this is where you really need to go into the debates in Congress to talk about why they're doing it, because nine times out of ten, they change the language to make it either more sterile or more clear, you know, more succinct and clear. And in some, and in this particular case, I'm going, what the heck? It's just, it's almost like Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. I mean, they could have made that far clearer, more succinct than the way they did that. And I think because of what they did and how they did it, it has been problematic for people to read that and go, what the heck? And it just flies over their head. Anyway, I don't want to belabor the point. This is where we really have to have all of the debates in Congress for each of the amendments, because then you can really go through what the real intent, especially if this is an amendment that was driven by Congress. Now, technically, who drove this amendment? There's two ways an amendment can be pushed. Even though it's coming from Congress, there's two ways amendments can be pushed. The states can tell Congress, we want an amendment. And Congress, when enough states kind of come forward and say, we want an amendment, then they'll pass it, because it'd be foolish not to. If you've got 35 states, you know, then you're risking the danger of them convening a convention. And especially if you've got 38 states that say, give us an amendment very specific to do this. Boom. I mean, if Congress doesn't do it, then they will convene a convention and maybe they'll do a few other things. But anyway, my point is that when you look at each of the amendments, an important piece of information that underlies each of these is who drove it, who was demanding this amendment. So this technically right here was an amendment that was driven by the states. When we look at the Prohibition Amendment, who drove that? It was the states. It was the women, the moms and mothers and, you know, wives and, you know, all these people concerned about the morals of our society going in the wrong direction. And, you know, they thought that it was the evil. And they wanted to dismantle this evil influence in America. Therefore, they pushed for that amendment. The amendment before that, the 14th Amendment, 17th. The 17th Amendment was driven by the states as well. Most people don't even know that. There were states that were refusing to seat their senators, to actually send senators. And so they basically, the other states said, hey, if they're not going to do this, then we need to change this mechanism to make them, you know, allow senators to be chosen by, you know, the people in voting versus by appointment. Because these other states, these particular states, aren't appointing their senators. So, to be clear, it wasn't driven by Congress. The globalists were out working with the states and causing the shortage of senators and keeping them from... These were progressive states where they were keeping the senators. By design, they wanted to actually change this mechanism so that it would force or change a paradigm so that when people looked at the 17th Amendment, they would think that the state legislature no longer has suffrage, which is, we cover this all the time, that is not the case, but we're heading into a hard break. We will be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so so we're back to this section that kind of throws me off. And so, anyway, we've kind of covered the, you know, who drove this and so forth. And actually, folks, if you really think about it, I would probably say, if off the top of my head, I think out of the 28 amendments, out of the 28, I think 18, if not more, almost two-thirds, if not more, of the amendments have all originated or have been basically demanded by the states. So it's not like the states can't get amendments. And if you look at the 28th Amendment, which is the 27th, what you look at today, that amendment was actually an amendment of Madison's out of the Bill of Rights. It was the Second Amendment, the second original out of the 12. And the whole point of that amendment being passed was more of a, I'll just say, a student's reaction to his professor shutting him down, saying, you can't pass that amendment. There's no way that amendment can pass. And he proved him wrong. If this actually, it was in his paper. He wrote this in a paper that it could be done. And the professor basically, I think, gave him an F or a really bad grade. And this guy went to prove him wrong. And he did. So, anyway, let's go ahead and do Section 3. Tammy, you're up.
This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by conventions in the several states as provided in the Constitution within 7 years of the date of the submission hereof to the states by the Congress.
Okay, so what's unique about this one amendment? You just covered it.
Well, it specifically says it will be inoperative.
No, no, no. How is it to be ratified?
Well, by the submission of the states by Congress?
No,
to the states by
read
Congress.
It again. Read it again. It shall have been ratified.
The Constitution by the convention.
There you by go, convention. By conventions. That's big, isn't it? That's different. Go look
different
at.
Different than the legislators.
That is correct. That is correct. And so how many times?
So each state would have had to have their own convention?
Yes, each state had to have a convention to ratify it. Yes, correct. So
what was the reasoning behind that? Was that because there were the churches and the religious groups were more involved with the prohibition than the legislators were?
Well, so I think it went by convention just due to the fact that, because when you look, why did they do a by convention for the Constitution in the first place? The reason why is because they knew that there were too many states that were corrupted with their own power. They already had all the power, and they were doing everything they could not to give Continental Congress the power necessary. So what they decided was, they said, well, okay, this needs to be ratified by a convention within each of the states, a convention of the people or their delegates, right? And so that's what they did. And the Constitution included that process of either being ratified by the state legislatures or by a convention. And so it's interesting. How many people do you hear say, hey, they've ratified amendments by conventions before? As a matter of fact, I think I've heard people that are in the Article 5 convention binary argument who's basically obfuscating the real process of what it takes to get the government into compliance. But that all being said, I've heard it said that it's never been done, that there's never been an amendment that was ratified by conventions. Now, whether the 21st Amendment was ratified by convention or not may be one thing, but it's right here where it says it shall be done that way. So whether they did it or not, whether the state legislatures, but I believe that the reason why they decided to go to conventions is because of the, I'll just say the lobbyists and so forth, might be persuading the state legislature inappropriately, and they wanted to make sure that it wasn't encumbered by the politics and the money greasing the skids within the state. So
would it just have to be 3/4 of the states?
Well, it still would be 3/4 of the states. It's still 3/4. Yeah, it's still, so each state would basically go through, and well, I've never garnered, because I've never gone through to determine whether it was by county, whether the ratifications were done by county, or whether the ratifications were done by popular vote. In other words, because they go by delegations, right? So it all depends on the convention of the state, how they want that convention to function. If by county, then that means that by delegation, each county gets one vote. And so they do a vote for the county, for, okay, all in this county vote, and then they vote for, vote against, okay, that county is ratified. This county has ratified it. And so that way it's literally one vote total for each county. That's what by delegation means.
Gotcha.
Okay. So 22. I think, Sean, you're up.
Already, sir.
All right, go ahead.
And we are on, I'm going up to check the 7th article.
Okay, it's 22. We're on 22, the Article 22 or the 22nd Amendment. Now, this starts with something that we see in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, as well as other parts of Article 1 and so forth. It starts with no person.
Section 1.
Uh-huh. 22.
No person.
There you go.
No person shall be elected to the office of president of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of president more than once. But this article should not apply to any person holding the office of president when this article was proposed by the Congress, and shall not prevent any person who may be holding the office of president or acting as president during the term within which this article becomes operative from holding the office of president or acting as president during the remainder of such term.
Okay. So this is another swipe, I would say, at FDR, because he had already served his third term or was in the process of that. And so they wanted to make sure that it wasn't a real personal swipe by, you know, putting that in there, that this doesn't become operative from holding the office of president or acting as president during the remainder of such term. In other words, it wasn't to remove him. It was basically saying, this is your last term, buddy. Okay, so the section two, go ahead, Tammy.
This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission to the states by the Congress.
Okay.
That's so weird. So this one switches to the legislatures.
Well, so most of them do. Most of them do. They basically come out, and some of the amendments don't even state whether it's going to the legislature or convention. That may be an administrative note that they put, you know, into an accompanying paper to say, hey, here's the amendment, and we need you to ratify this by, you know, via the legislature or via convention. But that one time on the 22nd Amendment, that was big. That's something to be take note of. Anyway, the 23rd Amendment. Now, this is highlighted because, and it's got this fuchsia or whatever, pot pink. I've done some things in photography and all of that. But anyway, I think some would call it maybe magenta. But anyway, This amendment directly violates the exclusive legislative clause because as it stands, the entire District of Columbia is under exclusive legislation of the United States Congress. What they're doing here is they're basically making the District of Columbia something that is not the federal government, that is basically preparing it or making it look or quack like a duck or function like a state. Now, I've said this before. We've talked about consequences. When you move along the Gulf Coast shoreline, there's a good chance you're going to get hit by a hurricane. And so, you know, that's on you. If you live, you know, right next to the Andreas Fault, there's a good chance you're going to get hit by an earthquake. That's on you. If you, you know, if you build a house at the very top of Mount Rainier, there's a very good chance you're going to be locked in by weather lots of times in the year. That's on you. In other words, there are consequences to the decisions we make. As a matter of fact, there are some really tough consequences out there. Go live in Wyoming. Wyoming does not have a healthcare system. I should say they don't have hospitals. So getting emergent care, urgency care, like, you know, an ambulatory care, how tough is that, Tammy?
And how we have it.
You have it, but how expensive is it? Because nobody really wants to pay for it. It just makes it
better than a sleuth.
So the
well, in Washakie County, it's paid for by our taxes.
Yes, I understand that. And if it's a small county or what have you, but still, it is a huge cost to have, and because it's something that you pay for it every day, whether you use it or not. To have those EMTs, to have the vehicle, to have the you pay for all of that. And if you only use it once or twice a year, and they say, well, it's worth that, but Wyoming survived.
Well, lots of life flights out of here just because we don't have the capability here at the hospital.
That's right.
To do most things.
That's right. And unfortunately, that means that probably there's the level of urgency could actually say, well, this guy's not going to make it. But they still try to get him there.
Sure.
Right. But the point is that when you live in such a rural area, and if the people don't want to spend the taxes on, you know, these types of amenities, because that's really an amenity. It's the same thing with, yeah, you know, if you're not going to build a home that's going to withstand that next hurricane, then why would people come over and say, well, we'll help you out and pay for a new home for you? And it's the same thing with tornadoes, earthquakes, and so forth. As a matter of fact, the federal government has no authority to be involved in compassionate services at all. Welfare or even, you know, disaster assistance. They may have created these entities, but they don't have the authority to do it. And so this kind of goes in line with what they're doing here, because believe it or not, the design of the federal government was to be autonomous. It wasn't to be able to meddle with itself. In other words, it wasn't to have any input on its own representation. It wasn't to have representation. It was to be the federal government, which was to represent the states, not itself. That's why it wasn't to be given a state status. Congress, this is why very specifically, Congress had the full control over the policing and the administrative affairs of the district, not a state. And so they came along, almost two centuries later, 190 years or so later, and said, hey, you know, we'd like to improve the validation of the Americans that live in the District of Columbia. We want to give them voice on voting for the president. But actually, this was a play to try to move Washington, D.C. into state status, to give them two senators and at least one representative. Now, This was actually the next step, and as a matter of fact, if you look at it, this was 90 years after the Organic Act of 1871. 90 years later, they said, okay, maybe everybody kind of forgot what we did here, and we want to be able to pollute the process of the choosing of the president. So who's up for this? Whose turn is it? I lost track.
It's Sean's.
Oh, okay. Ooh,
there it is.
There he's under the bus now. Go ahead, Sean.
All right, we're in section two. No.
Section one of the 23rd Amendment, Article 23, proposed 1960.
Okay. The district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall employ in such a manner as the Congress may direct a number of electors of president and vice president equal to the whole number of senators and representatives in Congress to which the district would be entitled if it were a state, but in no event more than the least populous state. They shall be in addition to those appointed by the states, but they shall be considered for the purposes of the election of president and vice president to be electors appointed by a state, and they shall meet in the district and perform such duties as provided by the 12th Article of Amendment.
Okay.
And in brackets, this amendment violates the exclusive legislation clause.
Yes, correct. So, I think what's really important is the fact that what they were trying to do. Here's a question. Do you think that there is a tally? Because how many people moved to D.C. for a two-year period while they're just, it's not moving their primary residence, right? They're just moving there because what do you want to call them? Aides. Yeah, so every congressperson has an aide. And if I remember correctly, most of the Congress people have somewhere around 20-some aides. In other words, there's 20-some people working for them. And a lot of those people, at least a few of those people, they bring from the state to be there. And they give them a good wage, and they got some decent compensation and so forth. Now, there are many of these aides that are what we call insiders. They become permanent D.C. residents, and they know the back doors of the swamp. They know, you know, the safe areas of the swamp. They know where do you need to go when you want the dirty deal done, that type of crap. And so the real question is, by doing this, how many people are going to be able to actually double dip on voting? Or even going through, because D.C. is the home of these corporate headquarters, as well as lobbyists, as well as embassies and so forth. I mean, if you really count how many citizens live there and how many people live there, I'm sure there's probably a huge difference. I mean, primary residents and everybody else, right? But nevertheless, what they wanted to do was they wanted to create a validation for these people to be able to vote. Virginia answered this. And I believe Virginia was the one, and actually I think, Sean, you were on this phone call a couple days ago, where I pointed out that Virginia had basically taken back its property of the District of Columbia. In other words, the federal government still owns and operates all its needful buildings, the Pentagon and so forth, but on the Virginia side of the Potomac, where the District of Columbia was, they didn't have the President's House. They didn't have the Congress, the Supreme Court, all those buildings that housed those who have been appointed and elected, the president and so forth, that's all on the Maryland side. Now, there's no reason why Maryland can actually take back its property but it would require an amendment to actually basically unsecede the land. And I say this because we are at a point where there is no need for, it's only been proven that the federal government didn't need all those buildings and all that space. They've only been populating to say, you know, hey, we got room, let's take on another role, responsibility, and power we have no authority to do. Is babysitting? No, we don't have babysitting. So let's create a department of babysitting so we can have this huge monstrosity over there, because there's lots of babies. That's a lot of bureaucrats we're going to need. Why not? That's what they've been doing. And so I honestly see that the best way to curb the expense and to completely undo this idea that the District of Columbia can become a state is these people that live in that area of the District of Columbia that's left today, they're technically Maryland residents. Get rid of that secession and allow, because the federal government has the authority to own and operate all needful buildings. They didn't need the District of Columbia. Do they need to have the District of Columbia Police Department? That's the difference between the state and the secession. And so if necessary, those buildings that are what we'll call sacred, you know, the White House, the Capitols, SCOTUS, where these primary offices are, you know, housing these very specific constitutional, the three branches of government, then okay, then create a little boundary around them and then everything else, and then they have their own police force for that. And I think give them, a sizable police force to actually really protect them. I'm okay with that. But to pander and to try to sideways in a state, to consider the District of Columbia to be a state, that is completely antithetical to the concept of creating a general government to serve and support the union or the states in the union, not to become a competitor within this amongst the states, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yes. Okay. So anyway, the other common little clause of this, the Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. All right, so let's dive into the 24th Amendment. Now, this was proposed in 1962 and ratified in 1964. Go ahead. Oh, Tammy.
The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax.
Okay, so basically this is the Third Amendment regarding the protection of a person's right to vote. A citizen's right to vote. And as a matter of fact, that right is not an inalienable right. In other words, you're granted this right by government because there are people that have that granted right denied from them. If you commit a crime, that your right to be able to vote and your right as citizen goes away. You can be revoked as a citizen. So you're not entitled. Just to be clear here, you aren't. This is not an inalienable right granted to you by God to be a citizen of the United States and to be able to vote in the elections. This is something that has been done by setting up very clear and uniform rules of naturalization that Congress has the responsibility to do. And to determine, because those people who are a threat are those people who choose not to do their duty or, you know, fulfill their obligations as a citizen of the United States, they can lose it. There's no reason. As a matter of fact, we need to go back down to that. We need to get there to where people really see, wow, I mean, I can't believe I can't vote anymore. I don't have any of these rights anymore. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, everybody that has gone through the path of national sovereign, whatever, you've severed your relationship, you know, and if you're voting, I hope they catch you, because you have no rights anymore. You don't have the right of due process. That's only afforded citizens. Now, I understand that there's people who have been in such a hardship, they've had to go down that path. But there are consequences. This goes back to the consequences of our decisions. You may be able, you may live in a state that may allow you to own land. That, you know, may live in a state that will give you some latitude to be a citizen in that state, to drive and those types of things. It's all up to the states, you know, how they're going to accommodate you. But the federal government, there's no accommodating you. They don't have any ability to accommodate you. As a matter of fact, if you leave the nation, if you leave because you won't have a visa or anything else or a passport, how are you going to get back in? Everybody that has taken that step out, you are in peril of losing everything, because at any point in time, we did it with the British loyalists. In 1783, that's exactly what they did to the British loyalists. They basically gathered them up and they deported them. And I'm a huge advocate of deporting our enemies. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're not a part of the solution, you're a part of the problem. And people that have gone down that path for whatever reason, selfish, self-serving, whatever, true crisis, true hardship, I get it. But as far as I'm concerned, you've become a part of the problem. Anyway, we're out of time. We're going to hit the 25th Amendment. There's a bunch of other amendments out there that have not been ratified that we'll also hit. And so we'll be wrapping this up tomorrow. And I guess we can kind of do a round robin on what did we learn and, you know, any other insights that we can get from from both Sean and Tammy. And so anyway, just giving them a quick heads up that there may be a test. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. We do need your help. So give us a call on Reclaiming the Republic, our contact info page. Thank you so much, and God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.